Hello, everyone, and welcome. My name is Eric.
And I'm Sam.
And today we're broadcasting you Psychology of Today for a Smarter Tomorrow. Live from Waterloo on Radio Laurier, you're listening to the Scholars Podcast, the podcast by students for students, helping learners learn. On today's episode, our cognition and linguistics. I would like to begin by introducing our guest for today, a professor I highly admire. He was my Arts and Rhetoric course professor last semester, and he has a very long and impressive career built off his studies and research in English literature, cognitive psychology, and rhetorical figure studies. Professor Harris is notably known for his awards and fellowships, such as the Outstanding Performance and Research Award from the University of Waterloo in 2005, as well as his book, The Linguistics War, published in 1993, and coming out with a second edition later this year. Welcome, Professor Harris.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
So let's kick right into it with a couple questions to just start off the podcast here. How you got here? You know, you have a very large and an odd group of interests, and you're now teaching at the University of Waterloo. You've got quite a few different degrees as well. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that journey?
Thanks. I think of myself as kind of an accidental academic, almost literally accidental, in that I'm a blue-collar kid. My family, my dad was a lineman, my mom worked in a hardware store, my brothers worked in the bush, and I was working in the bush. I was also doing construction and stuff. And I had no intention of ever going to university. I just thought I'd get a career in construction or logging or something, what all my friends were doing.
Right.
And then I broke my leg. I broke it quite badly. I was working on a construction site and a scaffolding collapsed, and I fell, and then the scaffolding landed on me and shattered my ankle. And the orthopedic surgeon told me that I wouldn't be able to work in a blue-collar job, so I'd need to get something professional. Mm-hmm. And I just had no idea how to do it, except I thought, well, you go to university.
Yeah.
So I went to university, and I just fell in love with it. I'd been a reasonably good student, but I didn't have much interest in what I was doing. I just wanted to get through high school. I wasn't, I had a kind of aptitude for it, I guess, but it didn't interest me. But when I got to university, I discovered the kind of flexibility of knowledge, the various fields I'd never heard about before, philosophy and psychology, and I just fell in love with learning. Mm-hmm. And I almost, within a first year, I decided I was going to get a PhD, and then probably teach university, but I wasn't even concerned with what I'd end up doing. I'd just get a PhD. And so I went through, I got my bachelor's degree. Then I went for a master's degree in literature at Dalhousie. My master's thesis became a kind of football between my supervisor and my second reader. As it turned out, they had been in the reverse roles on a dissertation the year before, and my supervisor had questioned that dissertation. And so now the roles were reversed, and this guy felt like he should be questioning the work that I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
I said to my supervisor, I don't think this guy should be on the committee since he seems to have an axe to grind.
Mm-hmm.
My supervisor said, don't worry, your work is so good, he can't possibly have any objections to it.
Wow.
And
wow. There you go.
If he does, I'll go to the wall for you, so don't worry about it. And neither one of those came true. He didn't go to the wall for me. I ended up having to change my dissertation, my thesis, in ways that I thought weakened it, just to make him happy.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I was thinking of abandoning academics, even though I loved it. My wife, proto-wife at the time, she talked me into actually doing the evisceration of my thesis that was asked for. I did that. But I decided that maybe being a professor wasn't the life for me, since they were squabbly, annoying kind of people.
It's a horrible stereotype you have.
Well, it was confirmed at the time. I ended up my next degree. I still thought that I'd go through and get the PhD at this time after I got my master's. But I didn't. I had my sights set on some other school besides where my wife wanted to go still. Proto-wife at the time. So I decided to pick up a second master's degree, and I went and got a psycholinguistics degree at the University of Alberta. At that time, it didn't involve me, but there was more political wrangling going on. That they were trying to decide who's going to be the next chair of the department, and people were lining up, and you had to affiliate with one person or another, and it was just kind of an ugly situation.
Right.
So I thought at that time, no, academics. Still, I'll get my doctorate, but I'm not going to be hanging out with people like this for the rest of my life. And so I applied for a doctorate at a place with a very commercial kind of master's degree, one in technical communication. And so I thought I'd get the doctorate because I wanted to, because I loved research. And I went to the university to pick up the master's so I could get a job. Master's for the job, PhD for myself. Went through that, ended up working for a corporation for Bell Northern Research. Doesn't exist anymore. But I got out of academics just like I wanted to, and was happily working along at Bell Northern Research. But I discovered that corporate politics is everybody's stupid and petty as academic politics.
Seeing a trend here.
Yeah. So that just kind of removed the prejudice for me against academics. It seemed to be a workplace kind of thing, not an academic kind of thing. And so through a series of events, I ended up leaving that job, again, following my proto-wife around. And then when this opening came up at Waterloo, it was the same time a job for her came open in Toronto. So I applied for it. I got it. And at the beginning, it was a very fractious kind of department. There was people weren't getting along very well. But we did a few things over the years, and it's become a beautiful place to work now. So I'm really happy in the department at Waterloo. But it was not a long-term plan at all. It was just the kind of stuff I teach here, I teach as I picked up along the way. So I got the linguistics degree. When I got the master's degree, I ended up getting a PhD, not in literature, which is what I was planning on doing, but in rhetoric, and that fit this department really well. So I ended up here just through happenstance. It's a kind of narrative structure called picaresque, where you just kind of bounce from spot to spot to spot, and you end up somewhere. No long-range plan, just here I am.
And quite literally through an accident.
Yes,
well,
yes.
Well, that's a really great story. And now you have a lot of... you have a really well-built-up career. You also have a book called The Linguistics War, and I understand you're going to be revising it and coming out with a second edition of that this year. Tell us about The Linguistics War.
Well, The Linguistic Wars, actually that comes up my academic career as well. So I went to the various universities I went to with different ideas than what I ended up studying. So I went to Dalhousie to study medieval romance, and it turned out that the medievalists weren't very good, so I ended up doing something else. I went to U of A to study hardcore syntax, kind of Chomskyan syntax, and it turned out that they didn't like Chomsky at all, but they had a really strong psycholinguistics area, and I ended up doing my work in aphasia. Moving forward to my doctorate, I went there to study communication theory, which is a quite fascinating study, information theory and communication theory, but it turned out that those scholars weren't very compelling, the ones who were teaching that, and I fell in with rhetoric. There was a really good professor there working on rhetoric of science, which is the study of how scientists formulate knowledge by debating and arguing and negotiating with each other. So I decided that I would pursue rhetoric of science. I had a knowledge of how linguistics operates as a science, so I was going to study an episode in linguistics. And a book had come out recently with a long, boring title, Linguistic Theory in America. But part of it analyzed how two groups divided over their idea about how language operates. One group thought that it was driven by syntax, that is, by sequence, by organization, by hierarchy, and another thought it was driven by meaning, by semantics. So that in one case you got the form first and then fit the semantics to it later. The other approach that you got the semantics and then that drove the form, and it seemed like an interesting little episode. So I thought I would study that.
Yeah.
And the neat thing about it was that all the people who were involved in that debate were all still alive, including Chomsky. Some of them have passed away now, but James Macaulay, really interesting guy. And so what I did, the first thing I did was to write these people, Chomsky, Macaulay, George Lakoff, John Robert Ross, Paul Postel. I wrote them and said, so there's this story of how you guys diverged in your linguistic positions in the mid-60s, and then it all kind of resolved towards the early 70s. how does this version that Neumeier gives in Linguistic Theory in America jibe with your memories? I got back a massive amount of letters at the time. Some people were on email, a couple of people. So I contacted them that way. I sent letters and got in touch with them by email. And then met with them and talked with them. I went over and talked to Chomsky. He was very generous with his time. Most interesting was George Lakoff called me up. I don't know if you've heard of him, but he was one of the he's become very, very well known for metaphor theory since then. He was very instrumental in some political theorizing, an approach called framing, how people frame their message. Right now he talks about the conservative framing versus the liberal framing. So he's a very influential scholar as well. But I got a call from him that must have lasted an hour and a half or so, where he just went on and told me everything in Neumeier's account was wrong. Chomsky was evil. that he was trying to squash this development. That it didn't resolve successfully the way Neumeier's book. But there was a new theory that was taking off that was really an improvement, namely Lakoff's theory. It was an improvement on Chomsky. So I ended up talking to all these people. I went further with Lakoff because I stayed in touch with him, and he was in Cambridge, which wasn't far from where I did my doctorate. And one of the times I was over visiting somebody else, I made a point of meeting up with him as well. Very generous with his time. Went to a place called the Commander Hotel, this kind of seedy bar in Cambridge, and drank beer for 5 or 6 hours while he told me all about the debate. So it was fascinating getting to know all these guys. And the book is about that episode and about how they positioned their arguments with respect to each other and how the debate ended up, in fact, forking at the end. What looked like a happy resolution from one perspective was really a complete division where they went off in different directions entirely. Lakoff in one direction with a bunch of folks, and Chomsky in another direction with a bunch of his folks.
So your area of expertise is specifically literature, linguistics, and rhetorical studies. How does psychology tie those together?
Well, we can leave literature aside for a while and just talk about psychology and language and maybe rhetoric. I do study literature a bit, mostly I study it for the way in which its messages, the style of literature. And that's, from my perspective on it, is rhetorical figures in particular. So if you think of the way the mind-brain works, it's a very complicated mental, physical organ. But one way of thinking about it is in two areas. One is cognition, which is the knowledge systems, and one is noetic, which is the knowledge itself. So we know things about the world. We know that desks are flat. We know that the sky is blue. That's the noetic stuff. The way in which that knowledge is encoded, organized, categorized, linked, is all in the cognitive system. So the cognitive system and the noetic system. And language really is the bridge between the two, because language is a deeply cognitive phenomenon. People come into the world equipped to learn languages at a massively rapid rate. One of the things that made Chomsky famous when he first came up was something called the poverty of stimulus argument. So the view of how the mind worked and how language worked, largely, this is a caricature, but largely it was stimulus response. You heard the word glass. You saw a glass, you connected that noise with a thing in the world, and you were rewarded by that because people around you recognized that you were talking about the same thing that they're talking about. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, you say papa, and then somebody with their big face in front of you smiles, and you associate that. So a kind of stimulus response system. Mm-hmm. You make a mistake at school, and the teacher raps your knuckles, and that fixes your grammar, that kind of stuff.
Right.
But what Chomsky said is, first of all, kids and the people they're listening to speak in inappropriate, ungrammatical, unfinished, stumbly sorts of ways in exactly the way I'm talking now. So you start something and you don't quite finish it, and you go back and you try again, and you pause, and you muck around a bit, and you finally get a message out. That's the way we communicate with each other. Mm-hmm. So it's full of errors, it's full of flaws. So the data that the kids are getting is mushy data. It's not really, we don't speak in clear sentences and very efficient speech, but the kids develop a system. So they understand what sentences are, they understand what phrases are, and even though they can't explain it, you can tell by the way they articulate that they know these concepts about language. They know these things, but they're not taught them. Their input is kind of mushy. Mm-hmm. And they're very rarely corrected when they make mistakes either, but they just sort of gravitate towards the correct ways of phrasing. So what Chomsky said was the behaviors method just simply can't work because it flies in the face of the data and it flies in the face of how learning actually happens. And he posited this thing called a language acquisition device that we're born into the world with. We're born in with a device that's ready to assimilate language. Sorry, I forgot where this question started from. Oh, so the bridge between language and cognition. So language is deeply cognitive. It operates on principles that we come into the world organized with already, and yet it represents our knowledge, and it represents it differently in Chinese and Swahili and in English. All the cognitive machinery is the same, but the noetic system is very different. Hmm. Language to language.
That is very interesting. I didn't even know about the noetic system itself.
So the noetic system is the structure of the knowledge you have?
We can just think of the fact that you know about things. Anything that you can articulate knowledge of, that's the noetic system.
Okay. And then you're saying, so those three languages you gave an example, is that Chinese, Swahili, and English, those would all have the same knowledge?
Well, what they have is the same grammatical apparatus that sponsors them.
Okay.
But they develop in different sorts of ways because of the language that you're born into. So kids aren't born knowing English or Chinese or Spanish or Swahili, but they're born with a system that can adapt to English or Chinese or Swahili, Spanish, whatever.
Oh, that's super interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting.
Do you mind if I switch up the structure a little bit here? Because this ties in really well to
blue. Yeah, so our structure was going to talk about cognitive psychology. We can come back to that. Sam, you have a perfect example about what Professor Ayers was just talking about.
Yeah, there's a really interesting study. So in Russia, this is what I read, correct me if I'm wrong, that they have two words for blue. There is, I also don't know how to pronounce them, Siny, S-I-N-I-Y, and Gulliboy, so there's light blue and dark blue. And there was a study that was done, and at the top of the screen that the participants were given, there was 20 different shades of blue from light to dark. Lightest blue was 1, darkest blue was 20. And you had a box pop up that was a random shade of blue, and you had to categorize them. And you had to do that as fast as possible. And so they did that with Russian speakers and English speakers. And the Russians dramatically outperformed the English speakers, showing that the way or the language you have actually affects your performance. And not sure how generalizable this specific study is, but just kind of that inclination that there are very real world outcomes. If you can now say beat someone at this very specific game just because of your language, I think that ties in very, very directly to what you're saying. And I think that's really, really interesting. Do you know of any other stuff that kind of relates to that?
Absolutely. The language that you speak shapes the way that you perceive the world that you're part of. Mm-hmm. And it affects your performance on various tasks. It affects your understanding in quite deep and fundamental ways. So, for instance, in English, in most European languages, we have tense. So if I say something like, the kids put on their pants, everybody who has heard this is going to either think of it as happening now or happening in the past. They're going to categorize it. But put is one of the few words that doesn't take tense. It's not putted. It's one of the few words that's kind of, like, there are words that don't, that aren't coded for, but we code so many of our words with tense, we think in those categories just automatically. Lots of languages don't have tenses, so they don't think in those kinds of immediately having to set something in a temporal frame. Whereas other languages have things like Kwakwala, a language in northeast of BC, the tip of Vancouver Island. And other First Nations languages have this as well. This way of marking your reason to believe something that's spoken to you. So one of the ways of talking about it is an epistemic marker. So they don't mark their verbs for tense. It's irrelevant to them on what the time of the utterance is, what time it relates to. They're perfectly capable of talking about time. They can say, Fred did something, and just add word yesterday or 5 minutes ago. They can put it in time, just like we can frame it in ways that our language doesn't easily accommodate. Mm-hmm. So the language is without tense. They can talk about time, but they just don't automatically categorize. Well, Kwakwala automatically categorizes for epistemic authority. So if you say anything at all, in the same way that we need to mark our verbs for tense in English, say anything at all in Kwakwala, you have to say, the kids put on their pants. You say that? The verb on that is going to be marked, the kids put on their pants, I saw it myself. So I witnessed it. The kids put on their pants, someone told me about it. So I didn't see it, but it was reported to me. And someone told me about it is then divided in two ways. Someone told me about it whom I trust, and someone told me about it might be a bit dicey.
That sounds really, really useful. And then there's more useful.
and then there's the one final epistemic category is the kids put on their pants, I saw it in my dream. And that's the highest epistemic authority.
And see, I think we were talking about that, Sam. We were talking about how the Inuit language has 40 different words for snow.
Yeah.
And how that probably eases a lot of confusion.
Yeah, but I just, coming back to what you were saying, that's fascinating that they have this inbuilt distinctions for if you believe something and if it should be believable. And that seems like it really, really applies to Western society and English speakers, kind of where we're at with fake news and everything. It'd be interesting to see in today's, like, with Twitter, with all of these things that are really, really questionable sources, and, you know, like, if Donald Trump has to give his speeches, and he had to put markers on all of his words of how much he believed them, and people had to respond with that, I'm just kind of theorizing that would be really, really interesting to use, especially in politics and, you know, the way our world is going with people really moving away from caring about how reliable a source is. I'm sure you get this pretty often where someone will just send you something and it's like a BuzzFeed article.
Yeah.
There's nothing linked to it. It just says, you know, glass of wine a day is equal to an hour of cardio. Like, I saw that and there was no link. There was a link that linked to something else, but
I think our generation is so prone to believing cause correlations that don't exist.
I almost want to just learn that language just because it sounds so useful. Are there other languages that have that? Do you know? Or is that...
Yeah, there are various other languages that have that. There are languages that that not only have tense markers, but have a whole series of tense markers. So immediate past, remote past, immediate future, remote future, mm-hmm. things like that. Languages, and again, languages that have no tenses at all, So languages do many interesting things to the world, and consequently the people who speak them perceive the world in different sorts of ways. So Kwakwala speakers will conceive of social relationships in a way that, say, English speakers don't, kind of automatically.
Mm-hmm. And to kind of add something to that, another study that I was looking at in preparation for this, they were talking about, I believe it was Dr. Viorica Marion. There was another interesting podcast called Smart Drug Smarts that's all about cognition and how to improve it, and they're looking at linguistics. And I think it was her that was talking about gender and gendered languages. Mm-hmm. So like French and Spanish, I believe, were both gendered languages. English is not. And how when they're looking at like table, chair, all these things have le, la.
Yeah.
And the way people actually relate to them, they would see them as, you know, having feminine or masculine characteristics that changed how they perceive that. And I just think that's really, really interesting. And would you agree with that? Like, have you seen that to kind of back that up?
Yeah, I mean, it gets much trickier than that in various other languages. Swahili, I mentioned earlier, I think it has 26 different genders. It certainly has more than 20 what are called genders. They're noun classifications of various sorts, and each one of them has the relationship between the noun and the world in a slightly different way. So they'll mark things like whether or not it's animated, whether or not it's organic, a whole series of markers about the way in which something like an article can match up with a noun, which means that they just think in those categories in an automatic way, in the way that that many European languages think of gender, and that English doesn't anymore. We used to have gender in English, but we don't anymore.
That's fascinating.
That is really fascinating.
I didn't know we used to have gender too. Learning all kinds of things.
I mean,
one more kind of really weird thing. I mean, there's so many, but there's a series of Aboriginal languages in Australia. Wurlbiri is one. Gerbil is another one.
Gerbil?
Yeah, gerbil. It's D-Y-I-R-B-A-L.
Not like the
gerbil.
Gerbil.
Okay.
But they have something called mother-in-law tongue, and it is a language, a dialect more than a language, but a way of speaking that men speak to other men in the presence of their mother-in-law. And that's the only time they speak it.
So is it like a more polite form, or is it...
It's a kind of code to help say things in euphemistic ways.
That you don't say certain things. Yeah. You say certain things a little bit more carefully.
It's so interesting that to develop specifically for that. I'm just like, that coming about naturally. It's just kind of funny to think of, like, all the blunders that must have happened for men and their mothers-in-law. It was just funny because it's been going on for, I guess, a very long time. But just to think of how often men have blunders in front of mother-in-laws to create a whole separate, you know, dialect or, like, way of speaking just for that. It's actually kind of funny to think about.
Okay, so let's jump back into cognitive psychology a little bit. Cognitive psychology is very vast and plentiful with research today, and to narrow down some of its most important aspects, I looked at my cognitive psychology class's textbook called Cognitive Psychology in and Out of the Laboratory by Kay Galati and adjoining authors, one of which is coming actually from the local University of Waterloo.
Oh, really?
I believe it's Fugelson.
Oh, yeah, he's a good guy.
Yeah, yeah, and he's a really good writer. I like the textbook a lot. And just looking for an actual basic definition of cognitive psychology is a little tough, but I did narrow it down to the textbook's definition, calling it our mental life. It's what goes on inside our heads when we perceive, attend, remember, think, categorize, reason, decide, and so forth. And I think it's also very important to talk about the, you know, history of cognitive psychology. The cognitive revolution being one of the most greater ones occurred following World War II. It shifted away from the behaviorist point of view, and it borrowed concepts from communications engineers that were engineers concerned with the design of such things such as telephones, telegraphs, and systems that we talk through, the systems that we exchange information through various channels of communication. So it has a very long and interesting history, cognitive psychology, concerning itself with communication. And communication is obviously a big part of cognitive psychology, undoubtedly, because of all of its processes that you can break it up into, such as, you know, morphemes and phonemes and such as such. We were talking about syntax and semantics as well.
Yeah.
So I guess the question for you now, Professor, would be, what are some important concepts of linguistics in our own language that we use on a daily basis?
You covered a lot of territory there, so I'll see if I can get to the final question. But let's go back a bit. Your definition of cognitive psychology, it's a pretty good one. But if you think of all of the terms, perceive, attend, remember, think, categorize, reason, judge, those are all things we do linguistically. That is, we talked earlier about how blue is perceived differently if you have different terms for blue. How social relations will be perceived differently if you have epistemic markers. How time is perceived differently if you have different ways of marking it. So the way you perceive the world is shaped by your noetic system, and your noetic system is built on top of your cognitive system. So think of something like analogy, comparison. One of the ways we reason, understand, categorize is by similarity or by a kind of forced similarity. So it's either a natural comparison where we categorize things together because they look the same, smell the same, feel the same, or we think about one thing in terms of another because there are similarities that we can use to understand them. So that would be on the cognitive side, would be that we function analogically. We understand the world, understand one thing in terms of something else. And then the way it manifests in language is things like metaphor and simile and analogic argumentation and genres like allegory. Mm-hmm. The way we attend to things in language are things like repetition. You say something several times, no one's going to miss it. You say it repeatedly, no one's going to miss it, so that it affects their attention. But if you say it many times, they've got it, and then they start to their attention starts to slip off because now it's dragging on. It's registered. So there's a trade-off between repetition, which is part of the basic cognitive system that draws attention to something, and overfamiliarity, the boredom that sets in because now you're looking for novelty. Okay, you've got that already. Mm-hmm. What comes next? So there's a tension between something that is familiar and something that's novel that shapes your attention, and that's our basic perceptual system. We look for reinforcement. We look for things that are similar to each other so we can understand them. But we also look for differences. In the savanna, we see lots of grass, then we see a couple of eyes, and we know there's a predator there. So we're looking for similarities and differences all the time. Mm-hmm. And that shapes the way we think, and we see that reflected in the way language is used all the time.
Right. You were talking about, I think you were talking about an organization system our language is built off of. And I guess one of the biggest debates would be, is it a hierarchy or is it a web? From your own research, what would you paint it as, our organization of language?
Well, both. We can't... language depends on hierarchies. So we have to know what categories are. We need to know just simple things like a poodle is a type of dog. That's a hierarchical kind of arrangement. But we also need... we also clearly speak in terms of networked associations. So you try to remember a word that you might have forgotten. You might be leveraging the sound. You might be trying to think, you know, what does that word start with? And then you sort of go through the list of things until you might get to the word. Or you try to think, what does it mean? So then you start to work from the semantic side or the sound side. So clearly they're linked in some way. That's not hierarchical. So we know what a word is, we know how it sounds, we know what it means, we also know where we got it from for the most part. We associate certain words with certain contexts, labs, books, home, things like that. So we store it clearly in a kind of encyclopedic, linked out, webbed sort of way, but much of what we're storing is also hierarchically arranged in terms of relationships of words, phrases, clauses, things like that. So it's both.
Right. It's very interesting. We just learned about that in my cognitive psychology class, and the way my professor put it is, it's a debate. You know, some psychologists believe it's a hierarchy that we organize our language. Some others believe it's a web.
But it's a fake debate because the web people, you know, can't get two steps without recognizing hierarchy.
Right.
And the hierarchy people can't get two steps without recognizing the web. And so it's more or less a commitment to one side of a kind of continuum when really what's going on is in the middle.
It sounds almost like the theme of your book, too, of, you know, people really taking a heavy stance on one side or the other. And then you said they kind of met in the middle eventually, right?
Well, no, they forked.
Oh, did they ever come back?
No, they never came back, and they're still opposed. Which is where where the second edition goes. So the first edition of the book follows the debate between Chomsky and some of his. They were actually students of his who thought that they were advancing his program, and he reacted badly to that to how they were how they perceived to be extending it, and he went off in a different direction. And then he recruited new students, and the old students and the new students fought with each other for a generation. And then what happened is that the Chomskyan group of students kind of won the war, won the debate, won the encounter. And that's the way linguistic theory in America paints it. So there was an exchange for a generation, and it was resolved in Chomsky's favor. But in fact, what happened was there was just a different program that began altogether that now goes by the name cognitive linguistics, that's associated with Lakoff, with folks like Charles Fillmore, who recently passed away. But a completely new framework that's very distinct from Chomsky's that now is now in many ways more influential than Chomsky's. Okay. But so what happened after? So the first book ends about 1994. That's when it was written. But the same trajectory has continued since then. And so what the new edition does is just follow that trajectory out, and they're further apart than ever.
Interesting.
That's actually a good segue. I'm going to change up the structure a little bit. I'm going to talk about Noam Chomsky, and then we can go back to psycholinguistics.
Yep.
So Noam Chomsky, his research, it was influenced and very in line with what we briefly talked about at the beginning or a little bit ago in the episode about how there was a shift away from behavioral theories in psychology post-World War II. So Noam Chomsky is an American theoretical linguist whose work from the 1950s revolutionized the field of linguistics by treating language as a uniquely human, biologically based cognitive capacity. You met Noam Chomsky.
I did, yeah.
Do you want to tell us about one of your encounters with him and how that was?
Yeah, sure. So this was in the 80s. Chomsky was about as famous. It's hard to quantify his fame because he is without question the most important linguist of the 20th century. Some people say of all time. He made the most significant changes to the way linguistics is done. And in fact, I said that he went off in a different direction from his students. And that was the sort of first of it. He's done that several times. He changes direction and builds up new programs. He's phenomenally smart and can recruit people to work on his ideas quite easily because of his brilliance and also his charisma. So I wrote him and just said, Neumayer says the debate went this way. I'd like to talk to you about it. He wrote me back basically, okay, I'm busy. But I have this spot open, and it was about 3 months hence, and he was in Cambridge. So I was in upstate New York, and he was in Boston. So fabulous. And this is quite typical of Chomsky, in that he will make time for anybody. He dismisses this whole encounter as saying that he wasn't even involved in it. His position on this is really quite fascinating. He says there was no debate. These other people, Lakoff and those guys, just invented this war. I never showed up. They had the war on their own. His position is really quite interesting. But he says he had nothing to do with it. So he's not interested in the topic at all. And his position is that it's not even worth writing about. And that's what I was working on. And he makes time for me. And also, I'm in a discipline that he has no interest in. I'm in rhetoric. He's in linguistics. Mm. And he makes time for me. He makes an hour for me.
What's the big difference? As someone who doesn't know very much about that, and just if you could kind of explain the difference and then like quickly define them as someone who doesn't know much about either.
Linguistics is the study of language. It's a very big discipline. So you can study the dialects and differences of languages. That's social linguistics. You can study how languages have changed. That's historical linguistics. You can study how language is developed in newborns or how it degrades in people with dementia or strokes. That's psycholinguistics. It's kind of the hardcore frame of linguistics, though, is studying what are called the levels of language between sound and meaning. So phonology, the study of sounds. Morphology, the study of effectively things like affixes, adding tenses and epistemic markers and plurals and so forth. Lexis, which is the study of words. Syntax, which is the study of the way words gather into phrases and clauses. And semantics, how things mean. And then there are other... So it's a very big field, but the core of it is a scientific approach to the way in which sounds and code meeting.
Okay, awesome. That's a really good explanation.
Rhetoric is the study of persuasion. So how language is used to influence other people's beliefs and actions.
Okay.
And so it operates, it depends on things like phonology, because the way in which you frame something, if you shout at somebody versus talking softly, if you talk melodiously, your sound is going to influence their perception. So every part of linguistics is important to rhetoric, but rhetoric is only interested in it for the way it influences belief and action, whereas linguistics is interested in it as a system in and of itself.
Interesting. Yeah, that makes a lot more sense now. Thanks for explaining that.
Yeah, happy to. And so Chomsky invited me over. He talked very patiently with me for an hour, and then made another appointment, and I met with him a month later. It was faster because we'd met that once. Very patient, very meticulous, very, very stubborn, very clear, and a bit prickly about some things. There's one brief moment in one of our chats. I said, one of the complaints about you is that you have mixed linguistics and politics. Those are quite different domains. I know you're interested in both. He was a major activist against the Vietnam War. He's still one of the most important critics of American foreign policy. He's a brilliant media critic as well. So I said, so people say that it's illegitimate to include your politics and your linguistics. You're selling your politics by your linguistic fame, and you're getting people who are interested in your politics interested in your linguistics. So you're mixing them to build your audience, and it's illegitimate. And that's what people say about you. I didn't say it in quite those terms, but I said, that's what people have said about you. How do you respond to it? He said, I don't do it. I never do it. Never done it. I said, well, for instance, your most recent book you just came out with has a section on politics at the end and a section on language at the beginning. So it's in the book. You've got them in between two covers. He went across, he got the book, he opened up the linguistic book, and show me some politics in this part of the book. I said, well, I don't think there is any. I didn't see any. And then he goes to the second part of the book, show me some linguistics in this part of the book. And he's poking at the book, and I'm just saying, I don't think there is this. The point is, they're in the same book. And so you get different audiences drawn to that right. material. And he said, I don't do it, never do it. We've moved on to a different topic. He's just intransigent. He is not... He doesn't agree with the version of the linguistic wars that I tell in the book. He disagrees with it vehemently. But again, very generous with his time. And so he wrote me, again, somebody writing a book that he doesn't have any interest in. We corresponded for a while. He wrote me a 48-page letter, not something printed off a computer, typed letter, single space, 48 pages, talking about the way in which my book is wrong.
Wow, he was very against your book.
Yeah, but I tried to reason with him, so I would write him back and say, you know, so he would say things like, on page 207, you say that I can't recall something specific, but let's just say that deep structure doesn't exist. So in 37, on page 256, you say that I claim deep structure doesn't exist. Actually, this is a really bad example because he did claim that deep structure didn't exist. So we'll just say X because I can't think of something. Right. On page whatever, you say X. You say that I claim X. I said, no, if you look, it says Paul Postel says X. In the context, it's actually a quotation from somebody else. So I'd write that to him. He'd write back, but on page blah, 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 you say, I say X. I'd write back, no, in fact, I say that Paul Postel says X. He just would not grant an inch, even though it was a clear misreading, and it just went on for page after page after page, which is quite fascinating because he is a really, really smart guy, but he is so stubborn that when he commits to something, he can't back away from it. And in fact, I published some more recent stuff about him and his history, and we've been corresponding about that. And exactly the same kind of thing, that he just insists that something I'm saying belongs to somebody else that I've accused him of doing.
It's interesting that all these like luminaries and very, very prolific people tend to be very stubborn or have a lot of these quirks, and you know, there's just like a few parts of their personality that tend to be like a little bit extreme and a little bit weird of anyone who's that smart. Like, you know, Steve Jobs comes to mind, of all the weird things that he did.
Yeah.
I think he ate like nothing but carrots for almost a month, and he started to turn a little orange and people started to call him out on it. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's a real story. It was in his biography. But yeah, it just seems that these like prolific figures always just have that one little thing.
But the absurdity of claiming something when the evidence is in front of the person at the time.
Yeah.
One of the ways that I've come to explain it to myself is that he is such a skilled arguer that he can persuade almost anybody of almost anything. There are legendary stories about these arguments that go on for hours that he ends up winning that are completely insane to begin with. He'll prove a point that no one would have even granted.
Which is interesting because he's using rhetoric at that point.
That's exactly
for
right.
His argumentation.
And I've talked to him about that. But he's such a good oral arguer. My sense is that he's also writing the way he's talking.
Mm.
And if he's pounding out a 48-page letter, he's not stopping to think about anything, because he does this. I mean, because he's extraordinarily prolific. He is. It's just like he's talking to me. His fingers are doing it, but he's like, I'm across the desk, and he's just saying things to me. And the things you can get away with in an oral argument are quite different from what you can get away with on a paper argument, because, again, the evidence is in front of you.
Hmm.
But he's not looking at the evidence. It's like he's just talking to you, and then he's done, and he moves on.
Do you think he's going to be buying your second edition?
No. I don't believe he will. I may send him a copy.
With a bow on it. Your second edition of Linguistic Wars comes out sometime this year. Where can people find that copy of the book?
Well, hopefully all over the place. Hopefully it'll be... certainly you could buy it from Oxford University Press on the web. You could buy it from Amazon. But hopefully it'll be in the University of Waterloo bookstore, I'm sure. So it'll be around.
And hopefully
and
Gloria bookstore, too.
Yeah. We're on Radio Laurie, so hopefully Guelph, too, if they're listening.
Yeah. All right.
You had a pretty good story about... We were reading your biography, and we kind of want to maybe talk about that for the last little bit here. Sam, do you want to tell it?
The opening line of the biography?
So on U Waterloo, you have a professor biography, and we found it very funny how you described it. Do you want me to read it, Sam?
One second. I'll read it. It was a good laugh.
It was a good laugh.
Second
page?
Yeah, there it is. So yeah, the opening line of your biography on the University of Waterloo pages: I was born in the new hospital in, how do you say that, Kitimat? Kitimat, BC, jaundiced, bald, underweight, and quoting my father now, ugly as sin. That's a pretty bold way to start a biography. Is there a specific reason for including that? Like, do you think that really starts off your life in an interesting narrative? Or tell us a little bit more about that. But you're doing better now, by the way.
Yeah, well, I have hair. I'm not yellow.
Yeah,
we won't talk about ugliness. But well, no, I mean biographies start with born in X. So
yeah.
I thought I would start with where I was born and what my distinguishing characteristics apparently were. I wasn't there to witness it, but I'll have to believe my father in that. I think though the next line is something like, and then nothing much happened between that and 19 years later when I found myself in university. So it was a way of getting into my intellectual biography.
Yeah.
So just skipping all that. I was born, then I'm in university. But I thought I would at least describe how I was perceived when I entered squalling. And
That's fantastic. Thanks for explaining that to us. That was just... That really... Like, I remember reading that last name, like, this is great. We have to talk about this.
I like the ugly S. Really great metaphor.
Yeah, hopefully your dad has changed his opinion on that, but, you know.
Okay, so we have 10 minutes left. I say we quickly talk about digital social media, because that has a really heavy
weight on linguistics and rhetoric as well. And then we can also try the Yanny versus Laurel, which is, ties into digital communication. So I guess maybe a quick question to start that off. How do you believe social media and digital instantaneous communications have affected our cognitive perception of communication today?
Well, it's not just the perception of communication; it's the perception of everything. I think, and the way that we can attend or fail to attend to the world. I want to back up quite a bit to the Renaissance. in the Renaissance, it's when books were invented. So there were manuscripts before that, but this is when printing is invented. And then what happens is you can mass produce the same information, not exactly cheaply, but much, much cheaper than a medieval manuscript that has to be written out by hand by a scribe. Mm-hmm. So the fact that a medieval manuscript is like the price of a Lexus, whereas a book is more like a month's rent or something. So you still had to be elite to get books. Prices went down after a while, of course. It got really cheap in the 19th century. But the point is, you could now produce the same thing that everybody could see at the same time. That gives us science. We don't, without that kind of distribution of information that is rigorous and consistent and can be shared so that somebody in Tuktoyaktuk is seeing the same thing as somebody in Santiago is seeing the same thing as somebody in Singapore. That really changed the way in which we could understand knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But print did something else. In addition to creating an infrastructure, a knowledge infrastructure that allowed a technological infrastructure to grow from it, in addition to that, it shapes the way you perceive the world. So research done on oral cognition versus literate cognition shows quite distinct differences. Oral cognition is broader and more temporal, more keyed to time and more distributed. So in a sense, you know more things about less. So that's, you'd think maybe it's social, gossip, stuff like that. But with print cognition, it allows in-depth, linear thinking focus for a prolonged period of time. You sit down at 8 o'clock in the morning and start reading, and at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you can close it, and you've, if it's a novel, you've lived in a different world. If it's a philosophical argument, you've thought things in different ways. And that sponsors the kind of cognition that is more deep than broad and more linear and more focused. And that changed the way people think and perceive as people became more literate. Mm. Well, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, electronic media started showing up. Radio predates back to the 30s or so. But electronic media changes our perceptions in various ways. But it proceeded more or less right alongside print media. So people who were involved in getting their news from radio and then from television were also still reading their newspapers, for instance. So they were getting some depth, and they were also getting some breadth. But scholars who were studying that at the time, people like Marshall McLuhan, you may have heard of, Walter Ong, they were talking about the development of a secondary orality, so an oral cognition that is different from literate cognition that's now, again, spreading out. But it's not spreading out because you're talking to a lot of people. It's spreading out because you're listening to the radio, you're watching TV. What happens with social media, with digital media, is those thoughts of secondary orality just completely explode, and now people almost only get their information in these sorts of ways. And you know, because you took a class with me.
Right.
I know as a professor, the way that it's difficult even to get students to read books anymore. They don't have the ability to concentrate anymore. Not all students, of course. Some do, but it's much harder to get a student to read a book. Read a chapter. So I'll assign something, and then it'll turn out the next day that 10%, maybe 15% of the class has actually read the assignment. And it might have only been like 8-10 pages, but they can't find the focus to do it.
And that seemed to be our biggest struggle in the class as well. I remember that. A lot of people didn't read. A lot of people didn't read thoroughly. I believe I'm guilty of it as well, the syllabus. And I think it comes from
you know, we grow up now with 140 characters, a tweet, you know, and that's what we're used to. It's quick, quick communication, get to the point. You know, very cutthroat media that we're being communicated now.
Have you noticed that's changed over time, like teaching over time?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I've been teaching 25 years now. It's changed really dramatically.
Hmm, interesting. And kind of wrapping up here.
But just really quickly to make the point that your generation is at the place where you can retain this kind of depth, focused way of thinking and breadth at the same time. But too many people are losing the depth, and that prevents them from analyzing arguments and thinking through things as carefully as they should, which is why we get phenomena like Ford, Doug Ford and Donald Trump, who don't promise programs of any kind. They just oppose things. just quick little things, because people aren't analyzing a platform. They don't even have to offer a platform.
Right.
They just have to spout off in certain directions.
Well, Professor Harris, do you think we have time for the Yanny versus Laurel? It's like 5 seconds.
Maybe let's just keep it to, you know, a few takeaways.
Sure,
It feels like you've got a lot of interesting things to say, and this is a show that's targeted towards students.
Yeah.
You're saying that people just don't seem to have the attention span. Are there any recommendations you'd like to give towards any students listening to this or just anyone learning? What are some takeaways that from your studies that you apply to yourself or that you'd recommend to anyone else related to these topics?
I would say two things. One is make sure that you cut the umbilical cords to your digital appliances on a regular basis and read. Sit down. I know that it's hard work for people who aren't used to reading or who are used to reading but only reading pieces of text or comments they're rolling by or something, aren't used to reading linear developed arguments, long narratives, things of that sort. Make the time and read. It really does affect the way you think and understand. And it's important. If you don't do that, you lose it. And if you don't do it regularly, you lose it. So read. Make a point of reading and reading paper.
Audiobooks.
I think they have they serve a point, but what you perceive temporally goes away really quickly.
Okay.
What you've got in front of you, you can always skip back to read. You may have forgotten something. Read off paper.
Okay, awesome.
And then your second point.
Second point is, and this is related to the kind of rapid way that politics is working in terms of emotion and hate and confirmation bias and so forth. Listen. Don't just talk, but listen, and listen carefully, and listen with discrimination and what philosophers often call charity, what argumentation scholars call charity. Just listen for the best version of what somebody's telling you. Don't listen for a way you can knock it down the minute you hear it if they're your opponent, or listen for the easiest way you can adopt it if they're your ally. Listen to it carefully, understand it, and then make a decision about it.
That's awesome. Those are some really good words to end off with.
They're really wisdom, very full of wisdom, and really knowledgeable. Professor Harris, thank you very much for being on here today. That wraps up our episode for today. We hope you learned something new. We covered lots today, and if you wanted to check out what we talked about more in depth, you can visit our show notes link to visit all the stuff we referenced today. We also wanted to give a huge thanks to Professor Randy Harris of the University of Waterloo for joining us today. His book, The Linguistic Wars, is available on Amazon.ca, and its second edition is set to release later this year. Be sure to join us next week, as usual, at 4 p.m. on Wednesday for another scholarly discussion.
It's a surprise.
It's a surprise. We don't know what the episode is, but it'll be a great episode.
We may have a chess grandmaster on talking about something.
Perhaps.
Maybe
hopefully
not.
If he's available. that'll be fun. So as always, I'm Eric.
And I'm Sam.
I forgot your name.
Yeah, no, that's a tough one. I'm definitely Sam.
And this has been your Psychology for Today for a Smarter Tomorrow, a podcast by students for students. Thank you and good night.